you for joining us tonight, and welcome to The Wine Muse. The Wine Muse is live every third Thursday of the month here on BTR. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host, William Pollard, from Wild for Washington Wine, and we would like to invite you to join us by calling in tonight and telling us where you're at and what you're drinking. Radio's Third Thursday Wine Muse with me, Linda Rez, and my co-host, William Pollard, and our first guest of the evening, Hillary Scholand. Welcome, guys.
Hi. Thanks. How are you, Linda?
I'm good. How are you guys tonight?
Doing great.
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. None of us are drinking wine tonight, right?
I'm on water right now.
But we're going to talk about it. So
we're on water rations, yes.
Oh, boy. And it's only Thursday, so my gosh, we have a whole weekend ahead of us to catch up.
That's
well,
right.
And one more week will be Taste Washington in Seattle, and I'll be there for the weekend.
Nice.
Are you going, Hillary?
I am going. I'm really excited. One of my colleagues, Charlie Hoppus, is going to be on the Red Mountain panel, so I'm excited to hear what he's got to talk about. He's got a Cabernet from the Quintessence Vineyard, so definitely want to hear that, and tons of great wines to taste from many of my friends. So,
over 200 wineries and hundreds, literally hundreds of different wines to sample.
Oh, you guys are going to have fun. I'll be thinking about you. So that's why you got to drink water. You got to prepare for that big thing.
Right.
Well, why don't I share with our guest a little bit about our special guest today?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, so we're already speaking with Hillary Scholand, who is a winemaker. She's the winemaker for Sonoris Wines. She has a degree in fermentation science from UC Davis, and she started working and making wine in Napa. And in 2006, she moved to Washington State. Now she focuses on her own label called Sonoris Wines. I met Hillary recently at a sensory tasting at Fidelitas, and I also learned that she's a teacher, and she teaches enology classes via the Viticulture, Enology, Science, and Technology Alliance, also known as VESTA. So today we're having her on the show to share with us, teach us some lessons on how to appreciate taste and smell of wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's, you know, since you bring up Taste Washington, it's a good time to talk about that. Get your palate in shape, get your nose ready, and you'll be ready to tackle this 200 wineries.
200 wineries. Is that even humanly possible?
No. Don't try.
You definitely have to have a plan, and you know, you've got a range of novice, appreciators all the way up to, you know, more in-depth tasters. So you kind of have to find what you like, what you're interested in, or you pick a region, or some people, if you have a 2-day pass, it's a little bit easier. Some people will do whites on one day and reds on the next, or so forth. So you definitely have to have a little bit of a strategy, for sure.
That's for sure. So we were talking beforehand and a little bit about your classes and the ones on sensory perception. And one thing I found interesting before you get into maybe even some the nuts and bolts of it is that you do introduce wines that are bad, maybe a little on the spoiled side or just not good.
Well, the way it came about, you know, as a winemaker, obviously, we're trained to identify flawed wines. You know, we certainly don't want to put those wines out to our consumers. And so identifying those becomes part of our training in school or just through experience and working in a lot of cellars. But one of the aspects that really came to light in the sensory training was for tasting rooms. You know, folks that are pouring the wine out in the tasting rooms are not, you know, in the cellar making the wines. And it's getting them familiar with those types of things to make sure that, you know, when you do visit someone's tasting room and you're wanting to purchase their wines, that you're being poured a taste of something that's really truly representative of what the winery is making. And it's not, you know, an off bottle or one of those random, you know, things that happen sometimes with corks, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I also, one of the pet peeves with tasting room staff would be customers that walk in with perfume and cologne. And then you can't smell anything except perfume.
Well, let me follow up on that. So what would the taste of a bad wine be?
Well, there's a variety of things that can happen. Certainly, if you're using natural cork, there are, you know, some small incidences of what we call TCA, which is the corky character. And a lot of times, depending on a person's ability to smell something intensely, you know, everybody has a different what we call threshold of being able to smell something. It's almost like seeing color. You know, some people can see colors very well. Some people can't see certain colors, et cetera. So you kind of think about wine in the same way. And the intensity of smell is different for each individual. But, you know, if you have a corked wine, it could be, you know, you're smelling a very kind of wet cardboard type of an aroma that's just very unattractive. You're going to notice it right away if it's really strong. But if the wine is not infected to a very strong level where you're able to really smell wet cardboard, the wine could just seem a little off in the sense that it's not as fruity as the next bottle that you open. There's just a dullness to that wine. The winemaker is going to know that that's not right. But the tasting room staff maybe isn't necessarily going to pick that up because the intensity of that smell isn't there to trigger their perception of what that is. So it takes a lot of time and training and working with staff, and it's definitely not something that you're going to have, you know, one class and be able to teach everybody and they're just going to walk away and understand it. It's something that has to be kind of gone over with several times. But the trick to that is actually finding those wines, because those aren't in every bottle. It's a very rare occurrence. So
right.
You almost have to capture that by accident sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's other flaws that can come up, just, you know, cellar flaws or things like that in wines that, you know, you definitely want your tasting room staff to be aware of.
Now, do you have any strong sentiments about, you know, since the TCA comes from natural cork and not from something like a synthetic closure?
No, synthetic closures don't have that problem. The difference in synthetic closures, you know, there's pluses and minuses to both of those things. I know we're not talking about closures, but with cork, you know, it's a natural product. There's a natural chemical composition in cork that lends itself to the potential to being flawed. I can tell you that the cork industry has made leaps and strides in technology in reducing the instance of that for winemakers, because I'll speak for myself. I love pulling a cork out of a wine bottle. I do find it a little strange when you go to a restaurant and you're paying a corkage fee for something that's under a screw cap.
No, I had that happen to me. I was down in Palm Springs just about 2 months ago, and I ordered a wine, and they brought it to me, and they presented it for me to taste, and they proceeded to screw off the cap. I was like, really? I got to taste this? I mean, why? What's the point? It must be good.
Yeah. Well, I think for a certain price point of wine, maybe it's necessary. You know, we are seeing higher price point wines, you know, $30, $40 wines that are going under screw cap. And, you know, from a winemaker's perspective, they want to preserve their product in the best way possible. And they want to, you know, it's quality assurance. And in other industries, you know, failure rate of these types of closures would be unacceptable if there was a 2% failure rate.
Yeah.
You know, so in cork, you know, to see a 1-2% failure rate, you know, winemaking is a rare industry where we just kind of accept it because we know that that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
With screw caps and synthetics, you know, that doesn't necessarily occur.
Well, let's get on to the sensory part now. I'm going to, William's trying to hijack you over to cork.
I know, I always
So when you do these classes, and they sounded fascinating, William told me about them last month when we did the Wine Muse. What do you do? How do you set them up, and what, you know, and how do you have food out and that kind of thing, and how does it work?
Well, I start with the sensory. I don't want to get your palate and your nose too confused with setting out goodies to eat beforehand.
Oh,
so
darn.
it's almost like boot camp, you know. You gotta go in and take the test first, and then you go to the bar afterwards. But it's important to understand that everything that we use for sensory analysis can be found in your home. And most likely, you know, you probably use some of these things on a daily basis. And the problem with sensory in wine is that the presence of alcohol distorts the aroma just enough where you don't quite recognize it. So something that's, you know, take raspberries, for instance. You know, maybe you have some in your refrigerator at home right now that you make smoothies with in the morning, or you put on your granola. You know what raspberries smell like. You've may have had a raspberry sauce on your ice cream or something to that degree. So you know what that is. When you smell raspberries in wine, it's almost like, well, I think I know what that is, but I just can't put my finger on it. And it's because there's an alcohol component there. So what we try to do in sensory is we try to take those very standard aromatic components that you have in your house, in your spice cabinet, and in your refrigerator, and we soak them in an alcohol medium. And in order to do that, we use maybe a very low alcohol standard wine. So take like a liter and a half of, you know, a Gallo red and a Gallo white. Those wines, and I hate to say this, but it's kind of like Budweiser. You know, those wines are all the same,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it just smells like wine. It smells like white wine. It smells like red wine. There isn't really any true depth to these types of wines. So what I'm after is a neutral type of wine with an 11 to 12% alcohol that I can use as a base wine. And then what I do is in small little jars, I'll build up certain sensory components. So I'll add honey to a sample and let that soak and take on a honey. And obviously I add natural honey, but I add an amount where it's going to be fairly easy for you to smell that particular thing. And what I'm trying to do is integrate that into the wine medium with the alcohol so that you understand honey on its own, but honey and wine smells just slightly different. And really it's a training of your nose. And you're trying to train your memory and your nose. So it's a memory of smell. And that's how, you know, we did it in school as well.
Very cool. So what kinds of things would you put out then besides honey?
So for the white wines, honey is really great when you're trying to evaluate wines like Viognier and more of the floral things. Sauvignon Blancs, for example, tend to be more citrusy. So I'll use grapefruit and lemon, about a teaspoon of each, to mimic a citrus note. And you have to kind of play around a little bit because you don't want it to smell so strong of citrus that you don't get any of the wine background component, because the idea is to have it integrated in wine. So we'll use butter, vanilla, because butter and vanilla come from wood barrel components. Mm-hmm. Gosh, for the reds, you know, we use all the raspberry, strawberry, blackberry. It's almost endless. If you have the wine aroma wheel, Ann Noble did a great job designing the wine aroma wheel. So you can use bell pepper. You can use, I used peppercorns, for example. So Malbec is a big hot button wine right now. And Malbec has a lot of pepper and spice and different things to it. So you can put a clove in one sample, and you can do anise. You know, there's an extract of anise you can use to mimic that particular component. So, again, you kind of just open up your cupboard and be like, all right, what's on the wine aroma wheel that I can use and put into my wine? Yeah, that's how we train. And you end up becoming very aware of your nose. I mean, when I started doing this, I have to say that some people have an innate ability to do this, and it comes very naturally to them. Mm-hmm. And there are some people that work really, really hard at it, but it just doesn't come as easily. So there is a bit of a gift, I believe. You're either born with an ability or you're not. You can certainly train yourself to a degree, but as you get into this, you start becoming aware of your nose in other settings outside of just smelling wine. Mm-hmm. So you get out of your car and it's springtime right now, and the grasses are blooming, the flowers are blooming, and all these things are going on, and you're just paying attention to the smell. So when people start writing tasting notes and you start seeing these things in tasting notes, it's like, well, where did they come across that experience? And if you are somebody that cooks or does a lot of baking, you know, you can tell who those people are by the way they write their tasting notes, because that's where they're adapting their sense of smell from, mm-hmm. you know. So you have cooked spices, or I use pie crust a lot because I make pies. You know, mm-hmm. it's that butter, you know, pie crust type of thing that you get sometimes in barrel aged Chardonnays, for example, or, you know, toasted brioche. You know, what do you make toast out of in the morning? I don't know. What kind of bread do you use? And, you know, it's just things like that.
You know, I noticed after the session with you and then tasting the Vitalitas red wines afterwards, I really tuned into that brown sugar component. And all of a sudden, it seemed like every wine had brown sugar in it. It's like, I can't put brown sugar on every wine description, can I? But I just became sensitized. It's that kind of caramel brown sugar.
Well, yeah, that's a combination of, you know, suggestive,
a little bit of
suggestion, but it's great that you saw that, because I use brown sugar a lot. I use powdered sugar in white wines, especially whites that have been in barrel. For me, have a powdered sugar. You know, I use orange blossom a lot because I'm a big perfume person, which shouldn't surprise too many people. But I can spend hours at the perfume counter and just go one by one and just smell. I love smell because in a perfume sample, can you identify spices and floral components of perfume? So to me, it's just, again, paying attention to your nose. How can you decipher that? Food, you know, you go to a restaurant, you order great food, and now I'm the one with my nose in my plate. Like, what does it smell like?
That's great. But, I want to eat with you.
Well, you know, then on the other hand, you know, it's a safety thing too. If you can smell gas leaks, you know, people appreciate that.
So with the program, is it mostly the sense of smell that you're developing, or do you also do taste?
Well, we start with smell. Okay. Because I don't believe that you can appreciate taste unless you figure out how to smell. And then as you develop your aromatic sensory abilities, when you start to taste wine in your mouth, you want to be able to, you know, inhale through your mouth and exhale through your nose. So you get that olfactory, you know, association. And there is a way to smell wine in your mouth. And what you're doing when people are breathing wine through their mouth and it's swishing around and you're making all kinds of weird noise, you're aerating the wine in your mouth, but the temperature of your mouth is also heating that wine up. And by warming that wine up on your palate, as you exhale through your nose, you're getting the aromatic off of that warmed up wine that's coming through your nose. So that's how you can actually, quote unquote, smell what's in your mouth. And I think that's really important, because you can have a wine that smells great in the glass, but has absolutely no character in the palate.
Yeah.
So, you know, what makes a truly balanced wine? And it's not only just aroma and flavor, but it's also a texture component too that we have to get into. So when you start tasting wine in your mouth and looking at your palate, for me, it becomes a combination of, you know, how does it feel and where is the flavor?
Right.
Okay.
So I learned something really interesting over the past week. I was down in California, and there was a session on, how does wine, you know, how does a tasting room teach wine tasting to a consumer that comes in for the first time and they're trying to explain these wines? And, you know, we've all seen the tasting notes, and brown sugar, you know, is on the tasting note. And it's like, you know, people may or may not understand that. So how do you get it to a level where folks can associate it? And I think everybody can associate color. Everyone can associate a textile feeling. So, you know, if you get the wine in your mouth, forget trying to smell it, but if you're trying to taste it, how does it feel? Is your mouth on fire? Is that just like a red color to you? Or are there highs and lows to this wine where it takes on sort of a plaid type color? So teaching wine in color components to try to describe it is something that's actually taken on some popularity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wonder why that is. Why would you guess that?
I think it's just a way to find some common ground, especially with novice tasters that are, you know, just entering, you know, into your facility. They're just entering into wine. They're getting to know wine. They're maybe graduating up from, you know, the $12 bottle, and they want to understand more. And how do you start that conversation with them? Because they may or may not have ever heard about a sensory class.
You know, I do use the descriptors like silky or even maybe a velvet or something like that for trying to describe the texture of the tannin and how it feels in the mouth.
Sure. You know, I use...
I never use plaid.
there's plaid. Well, you know, I'm a bit of a scientific nerd, I'll admit it. So I like graphs and charts and things like that. And when I am evaluating wine inside my mouth, it's almost like, is it a bell-shaped curve? Is it, you know, does it enter your mouth very soft and subtle? Does it build in the mid palate? Does it lift all the way up to the roof of your mouth? And then does it, you know, flow down the back of your throat and your back palate very smoothly on a finish? And not every wine does that. Certainly not every wine is meant to do that. Mm-hmm. But where are the tactile sensations inside of your mouth? Is it linear? Does it zigzag across your palate and go straight down your throat? You know, where is the feeling? Is it behind your lips? Is it on the side of your cheeks? Is it down your throat? Where does it come from? And everyone's going to be different.
I had a conversation with some house guests at one of our parties. Because my wife usually buys a variety of wines that she likes or that she knows that her guests like. And I don't always choose every single bottle. And I asked some of my friends, the bottles that I don't drink, why they like them. And they said, because it was like a straight line. It was just smooth and consistent straight through. I said, and you like that? They said, yes. So you don't like the big wines or the wines that have like a lot going on, or the flavors tend to be kind of aggressive, or they kind of shift and change. They go, oh no, I don't like that. They just want this straight line with wine for a profile. So that's one of the reasons I don't drink those wines, because to me they're not interesting.
Right. That's true. And I think it depends. We're all big foodies in this industry. So for us, I'll speak for myself maybe, but I want to pair something, and I want you to be able to get all of the components of, you know, the wine with the food. And, you know, I'll maybe choose a wine that, and Italian wines are fantastic for this. I recently went to a dinner, a Barolo dinner with some great Piedmontese food and the Nebbiolo. And Nebbiolo can be a very, very difficult variety. It's not necessarily a showy wine. You know, you put it up to Cabernet, and Cabernet or Merlot is going to blow it out of the water every time. So it's a completely different style. And when you pair that wine with food, it takes on an entirely different identity in a lot of cases. And there was one wine I remember, it had some very subtle spice notes to it, some subtle earthiness to it. And then as soon as it was paired with the food, it took on this buttery clove, you know, type of identity that had nothing to do with the wine as a single individual component.
That's interesting. So, okay, keep going.
Yeah, that's what makes wine very interesting to me. So you kind of enter this era of, is it a cocktail wine or is it a wine that's meant to be enjoyed with some type of a food pairing?
Right.
And then, well, I was going to say, I was down at Spring Barrel Release in Walla Walla one year, and when they do that, a lot of times they have food paired with, you know, little tiny bites of food paired with each wine, and they've taken time to choose those carefully. And so when we tasted them with those bites, they had a whole different flavor profile than when we brought them home and opened them and forgot totally, you know, I remember a couple of the bites that we ate with them, but pretty much forgot everything we ate with them. And then we opened them and it was like a whole new wine.
Absolutely. And that happens a lot. So that tells me that wine is meant to be paired with something. And imagine going to a tasting room or going to a wine dinner. And I find this concept fascinating, especially for the new age of winemaker dinners. I mean, it's one thing to go and meet the winemaker and sit down and have dinner with them. That's great. But what if you were actually taught how to cook the food to go with the wine?
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You know, you had a cooking class that say, okay, this is the profile of the wine that we're tasting. We're going to show you two or three different dishes that you can make in your home with stuff you can get at the standard grocery store, and how to make this wine come alive for you in your own home setting.
Are you going to do that?
I don't know. I think it's a pretty good idea.
You need to write a book.
Grassroots. I'm going to start it at my house. Who's coming over?
Everybody. You better have a big house.
Right. Right. Oh.
Yeah, but I've become involved with a bunch of food bloggers who do a monthly food and wine pairing Twitter session. And so we're all invited to share our recipes and the wine pairing that we did. And then we get on Twitter for an hour and we just tweet back and forth and describe how well it worked. And I find it a lot of fun, very educational. And I get a lot of great recipes. And I learn about wines I didn't know about too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great idea.
I do think there's a book here, because if you were to take us through in book form, because a lot of people can't make it to your house, nor would you want us to. but, you know, if you could do it and show some recipes and then explain which wines go and why and how they complement. That's another idea.
Yeah, that's
you need to write a book. Hurry up, all right?
I need to write a book. Yeah.
No, that would be really fun, because I see the colors, and then I need descriptors for aromas, and I see descriptors for flavors, and then you have the same thing with the food, the color of the food, the aromas, the flavors, and how they mesh, how they match, and how they complement. That would be a really beautiful cookbook.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. And, you know, a lot of folks run into problems when they do a lot of the ethnic choices in food. You know, you go to a Mexican restaurant, what type of wine do you order if that's what, you know, you're going for, or Thai, or you know, Chinese, you know, what do you do? Mm. You know, and I think it's all education to the consumer, you know, and it's getting them to try things. And one of the things I find fascinating when I'm pouring wine for people is that I'll get somebody that comes up to my tasting bar, and I don't drink any whites. I think they put a lot of restriction on themselves. I mean, they may not prefer whites, but I make everybody taste everything.
Good.
Oh, you make them, huh?
You know, I make them. You can't
have that.
You can't have the reds until you taste the whites, because a lot of times, well, they surprise themselves, I think.
Yeah.
And it's like anything, you know, when you go in with a preconceived notion of this is what it is. Now, that might not be what you prefer, but give it a try. And, you know, that's what Taste Washington is really all about. I mean, my goodness, what other time of the year do you get to walk into one building with as many wine choices? And, you know, Washington's doing some really interesting things. You know, you've got, you know, Chenin Blanc is coming back. You've got people making that again. You've got some folks out there that I know of that are doing dry style Touriga, or they're doing some of the Rhone varietals, some very interesting GSM, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre type blends. I mean, blends are obviously a big hit, but I think if you can try to find the individual components of the blend and understand those, you know, that's a key to really enjoying the properties of a blend.
Mm-hmm. So what types of varietals do you make in your winery?
I am a big Bordeaux woman, but I am not solely a Bordeaux winemaker. So for the white wines, I do a Sauvignon Blanc and a Viognier. So two completely different wines. Both of them are stainless steel fermented, because I enjoy a very fruit forward, crisp, acidic style of wine. Some of the Viogniers can be very cloying. Viognier fermented in barrel, you know, sometimes they can be a little bit higher in alcohol. And to me, they take on a syrupy heaviness to them that I don't really prefer. So for my Viognier, I love the honey, peach, nectarine type characters, but I definitely want the acidity and I want the freshness that wine brings. So those are important things to me. With Sauvignon Blanc, again, it's about that crispness, but I tend towards the citrus side of Sauvignon Blanc. I am not a fan of grassy New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs. So I can appreciate that style, and I will continue to taste those wines even though I don't really prefer them, because there are certain components. I think New Zealand has great acidity in their style. There's certainly things there that you can learn from. But the grassy character is not something that I prefer. So I try to make my wines on the opposite end of the Sauvignon Blanc spectrum, where it's the citrus note. And then for the reds, I do, you know, the Bordeaux, the Cabernet Sauvignon, the Merlot, Cab Franc, and Petit Verdot. I do not make my own Malbec. I use Malbec so sparingly that if I need some of it, I'll just get some of it if that's what I want to use. But to make it, I like Malbec, but I'm not a big maker of Malbec. Mm-hmm. Petit Verdot is my favorite variety. That's really something that I get very excited about. The Dionysus Vineyard that Sagemore operates, for me, is one of the best sites in the state for Petit Verdot. I've been working on that site since 2006. And it was the first vintage that came off of that particular block in that year. And I mean, I remember walking that block and I was, you just know something. I mean, it's an instinctive gut reaction that this is going to be great. And it's always been great every single year. And the reason that it's so good is because Petit Verdot is naturally a very high acidic tannic variety. Mm-hmm. So in order to make that wine palatable as a single varietal, which is how I make it, even if you're using it for blending, but it's important to be able to let that variety hang out as long as possible, get ripe, but also be able to naturally drop the acid in the vineyard. Because there's this play with acid and tannin that a lot of folks don't understand. So we'll bring this back to the sensory component. If you have a wine that's very acidic, the perception of tannin is going to be much higher than normal. So you're going to taste that wine and you're going to perceive it as very astringent and very, very dry. And your first reaction is going to be, wow, this wine is really, really tannic. That might not be the case. That wine might be too acidic to deal with the amount of tannin that it also has in there. So it becomes a chemistry balance where you as a consumer perceive it to be one way when the problem is actually something else. Nice. So Petit Verdot is a classic variety like that. If you're able to reduce some of the acid in that wine, you get really intense color. You can get great structure and tannin. And tannin, tannin is an antioxidant, and tannin does provide freshness to wine. So when you look at a wine from an aging capability, you want a certain amount of tannin in your reds in order to age them out for a long period of time and have them retain their freshness. That's really important. So growing site for these things is key in a lot of these varieties. Washington is still playing around with a lot of vineyards, figuring out what's growing well. And I think we're making some headway, but there's still some experimentation going on.
Mm-hmm. A lot. Yeah.
So there's the Petit Verdot. And then I do make some Syrah off of Champoux Vineyard. And that's about it.
That seems like pretty good portfolio.
Yeah. Try to get good soil. I have some Red Mountain vineyards for Cabernet, the Quintessence Vineyard, super hot topic. Charlie Hoppus is going to talk about that at Taste Washington in their sessions on Sunday. But the Quintessence Vineyard, again, another one of those sites that you walked the vineyard in the very first harvest that they had a crop. And I remember looking at my colleague and thinking, I didn't even taste the fruit on the vine yet. I just looked at them and said, this is going to be special.
Wow.
This is going to be really, really special. Mm. And I'm one of those people that breathes. You get out to a vineyard, you get out of the truck and you breathe the dirt, you breathe the air. You have to take, again, from a sensory perspective, you take in the atmosphere that you're in. And when you're in the middle of that vineyard, you're looking around, you're tasting the fruit, you're breathing everything around that vineyard, and you're going, okay, how can I capture this in a glass of wine? Mm-hmm. And the greatest compliment you can receive as a winemaker is to be able to translate what the grape tastes like in the vineyard to that glass of wine. And one of the biggest success stories I've had with that particular tracing is with the Gamache Sauvignon Blanc. I taste that grape out in that vineyard. It's a citrus type of a component, and I swear to God, that's exactly what's in that glass.
Oh, nice.
And that's the challenge. You're there as a winemaker to guide that fruit into the bottle to the best of your capability and make it represent truly what it is and where it's from.
Right.
So William was telling me that you're doing something with other female vintners.
We're trying to get the ladies together in the room. So there's a group of gals that, gosh, we've been hanging out for quite a while and drinking wine, and we're like, you know, why don't we kind of put a forum together and actually have an agenda and talk about some real issues and things that we want to accomplish. And it started out as, you know, let's kind of share knowledge, share contacts and information. And then it's turned into, well, we all are winemakers. I mean, down in the trenches, get your hands dirty winemakers. Why don't we kind of put a forum together where we present wines collectively as the gals in the industry doing the work. So we are known as the Sisters of the Vinifera Revolution.
Wow.
Yes, we're going to revolutionize the industry. I don't know about that. I'm just we may or may not, but it's a group of ladies. It started here in Woodinville, actually, with a group of about 8 gals, and I know that we're definitely going to expand and grow, and there's other ladies we're talking to, but we're hoping to, you know, get a group together and present some wines to the consumers where they understand that these wines are truly made by women. You know, and they're all small lots. Some, you know, there's a lot of women in this industry that a lot of folks don't know about. Certainly some pioneering women that we're very familiar with, like, you know, Kay Simon and Marie Eve at Forgeron, mm-hmm. and, you know, Wendy Stuckey at Chateau St. Michel, and Joy Anderson, and, you know, Holly. Gosh, there's so many women out there, but there's a next generation that's coming along that we definitely want to get out into the public and say, hey, look, these ladies are doing some fantastic wines that you should really know about.
Nice. Well, yeah, we want that, you guys on.
Yeah,
that wouldn't be part of the revolution.
Yeah. Get the revolution going. I like it.
What were you going to say, William?
I was going to say that concept of world class, I think, comes into play where, you know, you taste a wine and you go, wow, that's really special. And it could really stand up to all kinds of scrutiny. And then to emphasize the fact that it's, you know, it was made with passionate women winemakers, you know, and that there was something special there and to be appreciated.
Yeah.
So I would love to attend a forum, and I think that would be really neat.
Well, and I think it would be fun to have a few of us in the room, and we all do things very differently. And, you know, a good friend of mine, Lisa Packer, she just launched War King Wines in December, and, you know, she's such a great gal. She's so vivacious, full of energy, you know, a real go-getter, and she's making some great little wines. And, you know, it starts small. We all start with a couple barrels of this and a couple barrels of that, but, you know, people need to pay attention. There's, you know, Casey over at Robert Ramsey, you know, she's doing more Rhone style stuff. You know, Erica Orr, she's a big name in Woodinville. She's doing, you know, Chenin. There's not a lot of people doing Chenin Blanc, and she has a fantastic Chenin Blanc out there. So, yeah, we're all doing things a little bit different, and we're all sharing the knowledge.
Nice. I like that. It's a community that builds each other up instead of being competitive.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have a forum right now? I mean, you're not speaking at, like, at the Washington event?
No, we're a grassroots program. We are meeting in the backroom cellars of various locations. It's never in the same place, so you can't really find us.
you know, this would tie in well with a pop-up dinner.
Yeah, that's very, very true. So far we meet once a month just as a group, and we taste wines together, and we taste stuff that's not our own. The whole point is to get outside your comfort zone, and it almost acts as a little bit of a tasting group where we're able to, you know, share some of our views on particular ways that wines are made, certain varietals that are popular in. Then this discussion turns into what type of barrels are you using, or what's your fermentation technique, or where are you buying your capsules, or, you know, how do I get into, you know, pouring at that, you know, function that you're going to. So, again, it becomes assistance with, you know, making the product, getting the resources to brand your product and get it out there, and then, you know, having exposure.
Mm-hmm.
We're all looking for the same thing.
Right.
That's for sure. Hillary, how many, I'm going to let you go into second here because I know we've kept you way over, but how many years have you been making wine now?
This will be my 16th year making wine. Yeah. And, you know, I got into this business by accident. I was at UC Davis as a biochemistry major. I was going to pre-med and, you know, I stepped into a introduction to winemaking class. It was 2 units and it had a tasting component. I was 18 years old and I'm thinking, okay, this is my first semester in college. I'm taking a drinking class and my parents are paying for it. So I'm like, this is, you know, I thought this was a myth. You know, I mean, they tell you don't go to college and just, you know, major in beer, but I could major in wine. I didn't even know that.
I don't think a lot of people know that. Everybody needs to go change their majors from pre-med.
Well, my parents that weren't exceptionally excited about that in the very beginning. So, you know, they made a compromise with me and I ended up, you know, getting a job when I was 20 and started working in Napa. But, you know, the class was the right combination of the right instructor, the right subject at the right time. And I really fell in love with the culture of wine before I fell in love with the production of wine. You know, so you kind of had that artistic sense and then the scientific followed behind that. So it definitely was a marriage of two things for me that fit very, very well with my personality and what I wanted to do. But the instructor at the time was Carol Meredith. And she is a grapevine geneticist. And she was researching the origin of Zinfandel at the time. And I found it fascinating that this woman was traveling the world, taking grape cuttings from multiple countries, and she was getting to travel, eat great food, and this was a job.
You're very smart. You didn't take too much more to figure that one out.
Yeah. I want in on this, but the real moment for me that it was an absolute. Sign, seal, deliver type of a moment that this is what I wanted to do was I went on an interview at Pine Ridge Winery, and this was April of 2000, and I was 19 years old at the time during the interview. And at 19 years old, I had no idea what sensory analysis was, never done it before in my life other than that one class, you know. Mm-hmm. So I walk into the winery, and during the interview, they're taking me through the cellar. And I walked to the opening of the caves at Pine Ridge Winery, and I stopped, and, you know, the guy's talking, and I just inhaled, and I smelled wood, and I smelled earth, and I smelled wine, and that was the moment in time for me that I'm like, this is where I belong.
Wow.
This is what I wanted to do, and I really wasn't aware of my sensory capabilities. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. But it was a gut reaction feeling to what I was, you know, from a sensory perspective, what I was experiencing. I'm like, I want to be here all the time. I want to live here.
You found your peeps.
I want to live here. It smells amazing.
You can hear it in your enthusiasm and your ability to really discuss all these different aspects so passionately tonight. I'm just amazed. I've been taking a lot of notes as you've been talking. That's why I've been saying you need to write a book. But it's just all coming out of you just, you know, organically. And that's when you can tell somebody's really found their niche.
Yeah, no, I love it. And, you know, there's great people all over this industry everywhere you go. There's a helping hand. There's somebody that's willing to share their knowledge. And just in the last week, you know, I went back and visited California and a lot of my colleagues. And gosh, it was so much fun to walk into their cellars. And they're still as excited as I am, you know.
Wow.
So you find it everywhere you go. Washington is definitely unique, in the sense that, you know, you feel like you're in somebody's home a lot of the times. You're literally in their garage.
Yeah, you are in their home.
Yeah. And it's very inviting. But even, you know, even the big wineries and the well-known wineries that are down in California and Oregon, those people are still down-home people. They're still farmers, you know, they're still dealing with agriculture and they're willing to definitely share. So it's an exciting industry to be in.
True. Well, where can our listeners find you on the internet and elsewhere? Are they? I know they've already been invited to your house for that dinner.
Come on over. I'm definitely on Facebook. Sonorous Wines is on Facebook. I do some stuff there. I do have a website under construction right now, sonoruswines.com. So hopefully we'll get that up for you very, very soon. But check out Facebook, check out Twitter, Sonorous Wines on Twitter. And there's a lot of stuff that I post there about where I'm going to be, where the wines are. I do not have a tasting room because I am that small, super small producer that doesn't have that much volume. But you can definitely find the wines themselves in Esquin, downtown, De Laurentiis, some Wine World stuff. There's all kinds of locations that have it. So,
okay, I'm going to be looking for it. Well, this has been wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on and joining us and giving us this little tour through the sensories and also making wine and growing wine.
Yeah.
Okay. But, well, we do touch it all, didn't we?
We did. And we said 15 minutes when you came on. I totally lied. Yeah. You should have had a lie detector, you know, hooked. I should have been hooked up and it would have been just going off like crazy.
Well, it felt like 15 minutes, so that's fine. Yeah.
Well, that's what it felt like to me, too. Well, Hillary, thank you so much for coming on. We'll be checking out your wine.
Sure, no problem. Great chatting with you both.
Thank you, Hillary.
All right, good night.
Good night.
What a great woman.
Oh, yeah, she is. She's really neat.
Yeah, she is.
I had such a great time at that sensory session. And she just, you know, it's true. Afterwards, every red wine I smelled, I could smell brown sugar because I was so tuned into brown sugar.
You made that point very clear, William. Just kidding. So they do. I sound like they're having a revolution of this kind of new generation of winemakers, and they know their stuff, and they're very grounded to the earth and the terroir, and bringing that out and expressing it in their wines, and doing that in a way that's vital and unique and expresses, you know, their own personality too. So I think it's super exciting to hear about these new wines coming up.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, quality is so strong right now. And it just seems that people are open to trying something different. And there's a lot of experimentation still going on. It's still new. It's still, you know, something you can't say, well, this is what it's going to be like, because it's always different. And everyone's trying to plant different types of varietals in different locations. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
super, you know, exciting.
That's one of the reasons I love wine is it is not boring.
No, it's not.
And there's so much to study.
I hope she does write a book, because it would be fun to have a guided tour through, you know, make the, you know, this meal, and serve this wine and see what you discover in that wine and why it complements it and how it enhances the meal too. It would be fun to be walked through that, because I'm a baby and I have to have my hand held.
Well, you know, it's not always a direct kind of thing, and just, you know, I will often pick a wine. And then I'll pick a recipe, then I'll make it, and then I'll go, well, that didn't work.
Right, so that's why you want the person to write the book.
Right, well, then I'll raid the fridge to see if I have anything in the fridge. I'll start munching on things, trying to find something that'll match the wine.
You know, it's interesting. I took an art class one time in college, and the professor there, he said, I can't stand it when people buy a piece of art to fit into their living room.
Mm.
That really stood out to me. He said, I want them to buy the art. And then they buy or they make their living room fit the art.
Hmm.
He was an intimidating person. It really stood out, obviously, all these years. And now it's like a wine. If you do really want to showcase the wine, then you probably would be trying to work the meal around it, then vice versa, you know. But maybe not. I don't know. Everybody approaches things differently.
Yeah, depending on the wine, sometimes the wine is like a seasoning or a sauce or a spice. And then so it's supposed to complement the food or work with the food. Other times the wine is more of like a palate cleanser, where if the food's really heavy or fatty, you need something to kind of wash that away and start fresh with the food, start fresh with the wine.
Right.
So it depends on so it's not a simple thing. It's not always really, it's not always direct or straightforward. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I would love to see the book.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the number to call in is 909-202-8606. I do want to explain a little bit about calling in, because I have heard from some people that they're afraid to call in when we're talking. They don't want to interrupt. They don't want to be rude or whatever. But the thing about it is, when you call in, you just go to the switchboard and you get brought in the queue as the conversation opens up when we know there's a caller. So when we do these wine shows, feel free to call in. You won't be interrupting at all. And the number again is 909-202-8606. That being said, the next portion of our show, you can't call in. But on the next third Thursday, you can. Every third Thursday, we do the Wine Muse. It's always the same phone number. We're always at the same place. But we did do this interview with Y East earlier, so it's pre-taped, mm-hmm. and now you won't be able to call in. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go ahead and give an introduction before we go to our interview?
Yeah, we invited Michael Dawson of Y East Laboratories in Oregon to talk to us about the role yeast plays in making wine. And I think we both learned a lot about the role that yeast plays, because without yeast, there is no wine.
That's really deep. Without yeast, there is no wine.
Mm-hmm.
So you people who think yeast is boring, this is not boring.
No, yeast.
And it isn't, actually. It's very, very exciting. When I first heard it, I was thinking yeast, you know. But then when you understand all the different varieties and how they contribute to the flavors in wine, which goes along with our sensory show today, I found it fascinating.
I did, too. Always learning something about winemaking, and yeast is another level with a great deal of depth as to what you need to think about if you're making wine. The yeast selection is critical.
All right. So let's go ahead and play it.
Okay. Well, welcome back to the Wine Muse. Lynn and I are really happy to introduce our next guest, Michael Dawson. He's the brand manager from Y Yeast in Oregon. Y East Laboratories is a producer of pure liquid yeast cultures and fermentation products. These are products that they craft for the beer, the wine, the cider, the meadery, and the sake industries. So we're very pleased to have Michael on with us today to talk about yeast and wine fermentation. Michael, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here talking about yeast, one of my favorite things to do.
You know, I don't know if all of our listeners understand how vital yeast is to making wine. And I don't know that I don't know if we're the people to explain that. That's why we wanted you on the show today. If you could, we can start off simple and talk about what yeast does to make wine. And then we can get a little more detailed maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not an uncommon thing for people, even in this day and age of connoisseurship, to have kind of a gap in understanding of what yeast does. And basically, just in a nutshell, yeast is what makes wine. It takes basically sweet fruit juice, your must, and converts the sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide, a bunch of sensory compounds, or the organoleptic quality of flavor, aroma, and mouthfeel. Yeast is responsible for all of that. And it's just this tiny little microscopic single-cell fungus. So while you have varietals of grapes, which are very tangible, and you can talk about the differences between a Pinot and a Cabernet and a Riesling and soil and microclimate and different kinds of oak, those things are all very easy to understand, but the yeast, it's microscopic. It's mm-hmm. easy to overlook.
Well, now it's my understanding that yeast is everywhere on everything. So why would you need to add it to make wine, for example?
Well, that's a great question. Yeast, it's true. It's everywhere. And microbiology as a field of study has been around for a lot less time than humans have been making wine and fermenting things. So obviously there's yeast on your grape skins, there's yeast in your press and in your barrels and in the rooms in your winery, and it's everywhere. And if left to its own devices, it will ferment things. That's what it does. That's its life function. And it's been doing that for millennia, for as long as people have been mashing up grapes and turning them into wine. And some winemakers, and I think it's mainly in France, there are a few in the New World as well, but there are some that still stick to that what you'd call a wild or a natural fermentation that uses not just one, but usually a mixture mm-hmm. of a bunch of different yeasts. And that is obviously very cool. It's very unique if you have kind of your own microflora that you're working with. That's a really unique thing to create an individual beverage and kind of put your own signature on it. The drawback or the trade-off, I guess, is that it's a lot harder to control. It's less predictable. A lot of the wild or native yeasts may not have the alcohol tolerance. They may change over time or over the course of a season. And so it can be hard to predict your results or repeat successes or avoid problems in the future. And so once microbiology was understood, you know, after the work of Louis Pasteur in the last half of the 19th century, what became a lot more common, not just for vintners, but for brewers and cider makers and other fermentation artists, was to sterilize the must and introduce what's called a cultured yeast, a colony of yeast cells that's grown from just a single cell, basically. So you've got a single variety of yeast that will have the same alcohol tolerance batch after batch, year after year. It'll have the same organoleptic properties. So it's more repeatable, more reliable, more predictable.
So you guys manufactured the different yeast strains in Oregon, and then I assume it's a laboratory environment, and then you store and maintain those strains and then market them to different businesses like breweries or wineries to make different types of alcoholic products.
Yes, that's correct. Like you mentioned in the intro, which was very nice, thank you, we've got beer yeast and wine strains and yeast for cider, sake, distilling, stuff like that. We do have a lab. It's in Hood River, Oregon, which is on the Columbia, just east of Portland, about 60 miles. We've been there since 1986, so just about 30 years.
Wow.
So when you talk about alcohol tolerance, I assume that means if the alcohol gets too high, certain strains will die, and then the fermentation will stop. And if that happens too early, if you're making wine as opposed to beer, then that's probably not a yeast strain you want. You want something that ferments that longer, where the yeast survives the higher alcohol?
Yeah, to a point. A lot of the, without going too far down this rabbit hole, there are all kinds of different species of yeast, and then within those individual species, you've got different strains that are, same species, but they've got slightly different properties. I kind of think of those as dog breeds. Canis familiaris is one species, but then, within that, you've got dachshunds and German shepherds and border collies and all different things. And the major species of yeast is like that as well. Saccharomyces is the major species of yeast that brewers and vintners, cider makers utilize. And so I like to say that there's no bad yeast. It's just matching the yeast with the right qualities to the wine you want to make. So your point about alcohol tolerance is spot on. If you are making, kind of a very jammy, big Zinfandel, you don't want a yeast that is going to stop when it reaches 10% alcohol by volume in the must. If you are, on the other hand, making kind of a sweet Gewürztraminer or a Riesling or something like that, you may want a yeast that stops a little sooner and leaves a little more residual sugar in the must. So part of the winemaker's job, and one of the most important jobs on the part of the winemaker, is to have a vision for the end product and then kind of work backwards and find the yeast strain that's, oh, this is going to give me a lot of really bright fruit character in a red wine, or this is going to leave a little bit more residual sugar in my Riesling, and select the right yeast for the job at hand.
Well, now that kind of starts to connect the dots for us today, mm-hmm. talking about sensory aspects of wine, where you're saying that yeast and the winemaker's decision on which yeast strain to use can affect the sensory, the flavor or the feel of the wine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some strains will be what you would call neutral. They won't contribute a whole lot of or organoleptic flavor or aroma, which are really molecules that are byproducts of the yeast metabolism. So as they are consuming the fruit sugars in the must, they're kicking out alcohol and they're kicking out CO2 gas, they may kick out some other compounds that will affect the aroma of the wine, the flavor, the mouthfeel, and things like that. A neutral strain will not produce a lot of esters or a lot of, extra fruit quality that you will notice when you nose the finished wine. It'll just kind of do its job in the fermentation and get out of the way and let your other elements come through, the grapes themselves, the oak, your terroir. Other times you may want to kind of amp up the kind of jammy or graham cracker qualities of like a Bordeaux type blend or a Meritage type blend. And you'd want to choose a yeast strain that can do that for you.
Oh, mm-hmm. Now I usually, when I think yeast, I usually think Chardonnay or I think sparkling wine.
Sure. Yeah. And the yeasts, can contribute kind of that little like bready note to a bottle re-fermented sparkling wine, or that buttery note mm-hmm. in some Chardonnays can come from a technique called badinage, where the fermenting wine is left on the lees, basically the dormant yeast cells after fermentation is finished. It's left in contact for an extended period of time, and the lees are kind of stirred up, which will actually kind of get the cells to the dormant cells to kind of disintegrate and give this buttery quality and thicker mouthfeel to a Chardonnay. So that's another application.
Wow.
No, now I'm craving a glass of Chardonnay as we're talking about this, because I'm visualizing everything you're talking about. That's all, to me, that equals flavor and aroma. So I've taken it a step further, and I'm already visualizing the end product, which I do like that approach and style of Chardonnay.
Hardly anyone ever thinks of yeast in the finished product. I mean, it's just not something. I do have a question, though. I'm always concerned about or thinking about the cost of, you know, to a winemaker to produce a bottle of wine. And, you know, if they put it in oak barrels, 1,000 euros, that's going to drive up the price, a French oak barrel. Are there different prices in the yeast, too? Are there some that are just more rare or difficult to manufacture? And so if a winemaker is going to use them, it's going to maybe increase the quality but also increase the price?
For a cultured laboratory yeast strain, I guess I can't speak for every laboratory out there that's making wine yeast, but at least for Y yeast, our price structure is all the same for all the strains, and so it's just on quantity. You know, if you buy more yeast, you get a little bit of a price break per unit, but otherwise, the strains are all priced the same. It's more difficult, I would say, and more potentially expensive to work with a wild fermentation, just because it is less predictable, it is more variable, and there's more that can go wrong, typically, with a wild fermentation than with a cultured fermentation. It requires a lot more monitoring and babying and kind of sweat equity on the part of the vendor.
Mm-hmm. Michael? I'm wondering, how many different strains of yeast do you produce for wine?
For wine, we have about 10 or 12 different strains in our library that's available to the public. One of the services we offer as a fermentation laboratory is we will bank custom strains. If a vintner or brewer or whoever has their own kind of like house yeast, we will maintain that culture for them. It's their private proprietary culture, and we will maintain it in our bank and propagate it for them and send it out to them when they need it. But that is just kind of a way to ensure that the strain stays consistent over time. And, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
So
we have more in the bank, but they belong to other people. Yeah.
Okay.
So quality of grapes, you know, a lot of winemakers tell me, the wine is made in the vineyard. You know, you can't make excellent wine without excellent grapes. But it sounds to me like the yeast is really, really, you know, very important now as far as the part two of making wine, as far as what's critical in a component. You know, get the quality fruit, but now you need to have the proper strain and proper quality of yeast to make the wine that you're going to have. Because without the yeast, like you said, there is no wine.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you can't argue with that the quality of the fruit is of primary importance, and you can't make a classic wine with subpar fruit. The wine is made in the field, but the most perfect grapes harvested at the peak conditions can still get mucked up with a poor fermentation. Mm. So it's insurance, I guess, to make sure that your yeast is happy and healthy and is the right strain for the job, to make sure that the wine comes out the way you want it to, that it matches the vintner's vision.
Right. So do most winemakers use the manufactured yeasts, the controlled yeast?
I think that is a fair statement to say. I don't have statistics on it, but I think that more and more, especially in the last half of the 20th century and on, the controlled fermentations with cultured yeast is definitely the norm. And while there are still, some probably more artisanal wineries that are using wild fermentation, I think they're fewer and fewer as time goes on.
Just because a lot of wineries are looking for a consistent quality year to year to year to year.
It's true. And, just the whole global economy and transportation, I think, has changed not just winemaking, but, all of these other fermentation disciplines, brewing and cider making and everything like that. 200 years ago, 300 years ago, everything was much more localized than it is now. The microbiology aspect of it aside, you were making wine from fruit that you grew, or you were making beer out of cereal grains you'd grown on your own land or were grown nearby. And so now I think there are certainly cider makers who make cider but don't have an orchard. There are winemakers who will bring in grapes from other regions or other areas and make their wine. And
so is your market domestic, or is it also international as far as, shipping your yeast strains out to people that are...
We have customers all over the world. Uh-huh. Most of our business is in the U.S. And Canada, but we're distributed, I think, in 35 countries globally.
Wow.
And you also supply product to the home brewer or winemaker. How big a market is that?
You know, here in the States, it's been very popular the last few years. We've had the same liquid yeast cultures that we make available to professional vintners and commercial breweries. We've had those available to hobbyists since 1986 as well. And in that time, we've seen that hobby grow a lot. The home winemaking, home brewing, they're pretty popular.
You know, I've told Linda, I think, before, if I had a basement or my own garage without a car in it, I'd be making brew, beer or cideries or something in it. I would definitely be doing it if I had the place. I just don't have the room.
And lots of people are doing it. We were given a gift of home brew just last week. A couple different. It was one person who did it, but he did a couple different kinds. It's really good.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, I've been making stuff at home for many years, and looking at my basement in my garage, my wife could tell you that it's an addictive and all-consuming hobby.
I think sure. It's a great.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, but it takes up room that her sewing machine and mosaics could be otherwise occupying. So. I hope she's not listening to this.
Yeah, but something everyone can enjoy. They can, you know, you can give it out to your family
and friends.
Well,
exactly. At least she enjoys the finished product.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I did have a quote I wanted to share from Gordon Taylor. He's the winemaker of Davenport Winery in the Prosser, Washington area. And he said, "We're yeast whisperers. We want long-distance running yeast."
Mm-hmm. I like that. You know, they're really amazing little organisms. You know, we were talking, just to flash back to what we were talking about before, you know, how, you know, the alcohol tolerance is a factor. They're actually, these little microbes are actually killing themselves with what they produce. The alcohol becomes toxic to them as they build it up. But, you know, they do so much for us in terms of converting just this raw fruit juice into something so poetic and so fundamental to enjoyment of life and spending time with friends and family and things like that. So it's definitely good to whisper a little thank you in your wine, I think.
A yeast whisperer, I like it.
Uh-huh. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Michael, we want to thank you for being on the show today. This was fun, educational, and really added a lot more depth to our appreciation of wine.
For sure.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye.
Yeast whisperer.
That's good.
Yeah, that'd be a good tagline. I'm a yeast whisperer.
Yeah. Who gave you that quote?
Oh, that was... Davenport Winery, Gordon Taylor. Gordon usually traipses around in a kilt. He's actually, he was formerly a Canadian, and now he lives in just outside of Prosser, Washington, making wine.
Cool. And he does yeast too?
Well, he makes the wine, so the yeast is important. You know, you want that yeast to consume the sugars to make, convert it to alcohol to make the wine. And if the yeast stalls out before it's finished its job, then they're not very happy. And then they have to tweak and play with the must, try to get the yeast to reactivate so it'll finish its job. So they have enough alcohol to call it wine.
Nice. Well, that was very interesting. And a part of wine I never thought about. I have my grandmother's old recipe for wine. Sorry, my great-grandmother. Because I think winemaking used to be very popular.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the, well, forever, you know, in homes.
Oh, sure.
But hers was, it just said yeast. Just add yeast. She didn't say any specific kind, so I thought I would just use a bread yeast. That's the only yeast I've ever known of.
Right, and it would, you know, it would probably do some of the job. It depends, you know, what the intent is. Something low alcohol, something fruit juicy, or something with a lot of kick to it.
Right. Hers probably didn't have a huge kick. It was probably, she probably used a regular, you know, I'm assuming bread yeast. I don't know what she used.
Probably.
She was very sparse on details. Well, William, this has been fun, and I'm glad everybody joined us tonight on the third Thursday. It's always the third Thursday of the month, and you can call in 909-202-8606 and join us. But we do invite you to come along and enjoy the ride. We never know what our topic's going to be, but we have a lot of great ideas for next month.
Yeah, today's show was a lot of fun. And also, I want to mention to our listeners, if they are in Seattle, I'll be at Taste Washington the last weekend of the month. If they see me, say hi.
Oh, yeah, Taste Washington. Mm-hmm. Well, did you hear about that shooting in the vineyard down in Napa? That's another show we might have to do. Murder in the Vineyard. You don't hear that very often.
Oh, and we had one here locally, too, just not far from where I live. So no one was hurt. Just, the pickup does have bullet holes in it, though. I don't know. The story is still coming out. I don't know.
Yeah, wine and violence don't usually go together. But
you know, my advice, if you see a vineyard, you know, call ahead before you just kind of drive onto the property, you know, so just.
Oh, I see.
Just in case.
Yeah. Oh, and another big thing before we actually say goodbye here is that Walla Walla Vintners is released their first estate wine this year, right?
I believe so.
Have you heard about that? Yeah. And I know there's a lot of Walla Walla Vintner fans out there. There's another thing I heard about them, which is that they don't submit their wines to, you know, to be scored. They only did one. They released the one. It got like a 93. It was a Syrah, I think.
Yeah, I know some wineries like that. If I have a bottle of wine and I like it, I will review it. I won't give it a number. That's sometimes what they don't like is somebody giving them an arbitrary number and saying.
You know what? I heard them refer to them these scores as score whores. You heard that term?
I've heard a few terms. That, that's why I recommend or highly recommend a wine. It just means I liked it and I either, you know, I endorse it or I strongly endorse it.
Right,
but I don't give you a number.
Right. You know. But, you know, it is one of these things where a lot of people do, though, look at scores. And they that's the only way that, because there's so many wines out there, that's the only way they can differentiate one from the other. And so, and they don't have the luxury of going into the tasting room. Mm-hmm. So I do think it holds back, like, for instance, Walla Walla Vintners, they are one of the best wines I've ever had, and they're consistent from year to year, and they've been there forever. But they don't; their wines are still medium priced, and you can still buy them, whereas some of the other wines of equal quality are selling out in advance and that kind of thing. So I do think that scores have something to do with. And so I guess I'm glad they haven't done it, because I'm glad it's still affordable and I can still buy it.
Yeah, that's also one reason why people join wine clubs, is to ensure that they can get the wine, because there's usually allotments for a club member, and you can that way you guarantee that you have that favorite wine, and wine club members usually also get a discount, so you're saving a little money that way too.
That's true. And Walla Walla Vintners, I sound like I'm doing a commercial for them right now, but I'm not. But they are my favorite wine. But they released their estate wine last year, I think, to their wine club members only. So, you know, this year, though, we all get to taste the first estate wine from them. And I went out in their vineyard and actually had some of the grapes off of it a few years ago, off the vine. As they were growing, I'm getting them ready to. By that point, they had harvested some, but, you know, it was in the bottling process. But fantastic fruit. And so I'm really excited to taste their estate bottle.
Well, now I have to mention that the weekend of April 4th, Reininger Winery in Walla Walla will be having a Carmenere release and a vertical tasting of their Carmenere. And Carmenere is, it's kind of one of those lost Bordeaux varietals that was rediscovered in Chile. And in Washington State is starting to get a little bit of notoriety, kind of like Malbec was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Now Washington State and Washington Carmenere are kind of, there's kind of like people are all abuzz, and no pun intended. But the weekend of April 4th, a Reininger Winery in Walla Walla will be doing a special tasting. So I will be there for that as well.
Okay, we'll have to let us know how that goes. Mm-hmm. Carmenere, I really like it, so I'm excited about it doing so well.
Me too.
I'm glad it's doing well in Washington. That's pretty cool. Well, we'll go ahead and end the show, and we'll catch everybody here next week. Next month on the third Thursday Wine Muse. You can find us on Twitter. Just hashtag Wine Muse and get information to us. And you can find William over at Wild for Washington Wine and my show here on the show page on BTR and also on minstrelandmuse.com.
Fantastic.
Well, cheers, William.
Cheers,
Enjoy that
Linda.
Yeast.
Yeah, not yeast.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Wine Muse. You can hear more of our shows at minstrelandmuse.com. And you can find us at William Pollard's blog at wildforwashingtonwine.com. Please join us again every third Thursday of the month, live here on BTR for another new show.